You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about. There's something
it seems such a long time ago since we were last together, Finn, with a whole collection of fine folk, but yet here we are, and you've already decided on a really optimistic start to the next season of Past Prologue.
Well, yes, we thought we'd talk about ends of worlds. There's been a lot of sort of
Lots going on, exactly.
Well, particularly between, the jumping off point was thinking about Trump and the Americans and North Korea, but we're sort of broadening it out a bit to think about other moments when perhaps it seemed as if an order of the world was disappearing, a new moment was being born, these kinds of ideas.
That was so much
fun.
So
not totally apocalyptic.
Quick introductions, then we'll go straight into the first piece of music, please.
Yes, we have here with us today Dr. Tom Bishop, who's just joined us as a new modern Americanist in the school, Professor Krista Kalman, and Dr. Addison Morton. That was REM with The End of the World as We Know It. And we're going to start off by talking to Tom Bishop about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is in many ways the obvious point of comparison or at least connection to at least one of these possible End of the World scenarios that we've been facing or looking at over the summer. And I suppose the first place to start really is to say what exactly was the Cuban Missile Crisis, we probably all think that we know what it constitutes, but worth a refresher.
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is what a lot of historians consider as the true high point of the Cold War. It's this incredibly tense international standoff between the Soviet Union, Cuba and the United States over the placement of missiles or the discovery of missiles by the United States in Cuba. And it is this 13-day tense political standoff in October of 1962. It is really a moment when we kind of see the world push to the brink of nuclear war, and then just at the moment you think something might happen, it kind of eases up again. So it's really considered a kind of a classic moment of kind of 20th century history.
And can you say something about how we get to that point in international tensions?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of kind of the tipping point that comes around Cuba in 1962 has a long history of Soviet and American kind of antagonisms, which really start off at the end of World War II. As we see the United States and the Soviet Union emerge as these two global superpowers, fighting really over kind of domination within the world. And the events in Cuba really escalate following, actually, the Cuban Revolution, when Fidel Castro takes over power and forms an alliance with Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis starts, really, when at 8 o'clock in the morning, in effect, President Kennedy is handed these secret photos taken by the CIA, by his National Security Advisor, George Bundy. And these photos show that in Cuba there is the placement of missiles. And this terrifies Kennedy and his administration. The important thing to remember is that Cuba is just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. So this is not kind of a threat that is kind of distant in kind of Eastern Europe or in Vietnam. This is a threat that is directly close to the United States. And it leads to this moment of Kennedy calling all his advisors, what we call the XCOM Committee, kind of the best of the brightest. You've got kind of policy planners, we've got military generals, and they sit there and they discuss what the hell they're going to do about this, right? And Kennedy's faced with a number of options. You know, he's got his army generals saying that potentially you should actually send in troops to Cuba to kind of dismantle and destroy these missile sites. There's option of doing tactical strikes. There's the option, which eventually he goes for, of putting a quarantine around the island to force the Cubans to dismantle the missile sites there and stop Russia from sending anything else over. The problem is, and this is why we kind of consider it these two really tense 13 days, is that all of these options have certain risks attached to them. And that really is the Cuban Missile Crisis, this kind of conversation over how the United States should deal with the kind of presence of a nuclear weapon so close to its own shores.
Do they have a problem in this whole situation? How much do they... I mean, obviously they've got the photographs that tell them that the missiles have been placed there. Do they know a lot about the thinking on the other side, or are they in a situation where they're very much in the, you know, they're very much having to negotiate, sort of just make decisions in the dark?
This is a fantastic question. And there's a lot of kind of information that historians have been kind of constructing since the fall of the USSR and the opening up of archives in both Cuba and Russia about what policy experts actually know at the time. And the big figure who comes out of this is Robert Kennedy, so John F. Kennedy's brother. He's there as the Attorney General, and he is someone who is talking constantly to the Russian ambassadors and his Soviet counterpart to find out exactly what the thinking is on both sides. We know now that Castro was very much kind of in favour of using a first strike option. So if the US troops had landed from Florida into Cuba, Castro was saying that you need to give us the authorization to fire, okay? And there's one of these fascinating, perhaps the tensest moment of the whole crisis, is when another U-2 kind of spy plane is flying over Cuba and it's shot down. And at this point, again, we're seeing this idea of intelligence being so critical to the decision-making going on. And it ends up with this famous kind of opening up of communications between Kennedy and Khrushchev.
So was there a real... Is there a point at which, I don't know, the US is sort of seconds away from pressing the button in this situation, or indeed the Russians? I mean, for example, with the Susan Dow, the spy plane, or is it actually sort of further away than that?
I think the closest moment we actually get to them potentially pushing the button, and this is a debate for historians because a lot of people have different kind of perceptions on how close we actually came to it. For me, the closest moment is when we see the Russian ships approaching the quarantine that Kennedy has set up. And you've got this option, what to do, should you let ships in? Eventually they do let one Soviet ship through. which contains just petroleum, so they kind of let that through. But I think that, for me, is kind of the tensest moment we kind of get. And that is kind of potentially the closest we actually get to nuclear war at that point.
We were also going to talk a little bit about the domestic reaction to this. I mean, are we seeing panic in the streets of major US cities? Is there, how far is the general public aware that the, you know, conceivably the world might be coming to an end in this situation?
I think this is the kind of biggest historical work we still need to do on the topic. I think we've got lots and lots of kind of academics who talk about the policy decisions going on, but my own research looks at how people on the street are responding to it. And the honest answer is, it's very confusing. We're not 100% sure what people are doing. You get some accounts of, you know, shopping malls in Colorado suddenly having a complete sale out of all their canned goods. You've got people phoning up their civil defense office, and civil defense is, for people who kind of aren't aware of it, it's kind of the guide that people should follow if there's a nuclear attack. Phoning up their offices and then being overwhelmed. People on the street find it incredibly, from what I can kind of tell from my own research, incredibly confusing. They don't really know what to do, how to react. How do you react to the prospect of total war? But also the crisis passes very quickly. So after the 13 days, we go back to almost a state of normalcy as well. So it's difficult to kind of completely discern what people were doing on the ground. I think that's a lot of the work that still needs to be done. If you kind of talk to my dad, he was someone who lived through this. So there is this kind of generation who remember sitting in school and being taught to duck under desks as they're watching these events unfold around them.
Might come back to, to some of those ideas. But I also wanted to ponder, do you think we, because obviously, you know, there has been comparison drawn between the Cuban crisis and the present tensions between US and North Korea, and some sort of jokes being made, particularly on social media, about the unfavourable comparison, shall we say, between the leadership then and the leadership now. Are historical comparisons useful between these two events, do you think, or are we looking at a very different situation at the moment?
I think we are looking at a completely different situation. The situation in North Korea is fundamentally different to how Cuba was in the early 60s. I do think the biggest historical comparison we can make is about the importance of communication. And we saw, you know, the world might be over by the time this is broadcast, but we saw kind of over the weekend North Korea reacting to a tweet that Donald Trump had used. And one of the things that a lot of kind of scholars agree on with Kennedy is that the communication coming from his team is razor sharp. They're speaking with one voice, at least publicly. And I think that's one of the things we're not seeing with the Trump administration. And when you're having multiple messages coming out from the White House, that's when we see miscommunication and problems. And foreign policy is all about communication, as we know.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save. With the world in a grave, take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me. So mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of
senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
That was Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction from 1965. And we're going to go backwards in time now, from the 1960s back to 1914 and the outbreak of the First World War, thinking, I think, particularly about the experience of that moment in Britain. And I wanted to start, Krista, by asking you, to what extent do you think, or was the outbreak of the First World War the end of a world for Britain?
Well, of course, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and in many ways it is something that's seen that way when people come out of it the other end and start looking back. But there is some evidence at the time that people thought there was something very different going on. There's a very famous quotation from Sir Edward Grey, who was Foreign Secretary at the time, who apparently stood in the window of the Foreign Office watching the lights, watching lamplighters putting the lights out, and saying, "The lights are going out all over Europe and we will not see them lit again in our lifetime." So there's a kind of sense that some people feel things are coming to an end at that stage. There's also been quite a bit of apocalyptic feeling going on in the past 4 or 5 years leading up to 1914 that I think it's probably worthwhile reminding ourselves of. Part of this comes from a general sort of social, cultural, fin de siècle, fin de monde, fin de globe type mentality. You know, that this is the new century is both the start of things and also an ending of things. Victoria's death in 1901, although I do constantly say to students, people didn't go to bed the night before Victoria died, take off their hoop skirts, take off their top hats, and then get up the next morning, put on their Edwardian bustles and their bowler hats and say, "Whoopee, we're Edwardians." But, you know, you do see these sort of changes coming in. And there's been a lot of civil unrest in Britain. There's been suffragette outrages. There's been Irish nationalism. There's been Indian independence movements. So there've been quite a number of either political assassins or bombs, arson attacks and things. So I think there's a sort of feeling of churn in the air. And the equivalent of what was always referred to as the general strike before the 1926 general strike, when you see troops on the streets of major cities trying to coerce strikers back to work or protect supply routes and things. So by the time war breaks out, I think people are feeling that things are starting to change anyway.
Are there particular ideas? I mean, you've mentioned some of the things that were going on. Are there kind of, I don't know, fantasies of what a kind of an apocalyptic situation might look like here, in terms of devastation of cities or collapse of governments?
Less devastation of cities at that point, but there are certainly there's a big boom in sort of spy literature, and there's a lot of invasion literature. So there's a lot of fantasy about Britain becoming German, and of course one of the things that we need to remember, you know, we tend to think now, because of the poppy and the general consensus, that the First World War was a bad thing rather than a good thing. So we tend to lose sight of the fact that in 1914 a lot of people who volunteered really did feel that they were they were fighting a defensive war. And one of the significant things in this was events in Belgium, where the German army sort of passed through Belgium and left various marks. And these, in a sense, these became exaggerated, and they were known collectively as Belgian atrocities. And I mean, certainly the stories of bayoneted babies and crucified soldiers were slightly over-egged. But having said that, there was a very big book on this subject about 10 years ago by Alan Kramer and John Horn that demonstrated that actually there were things that we would say were against the Geneva Convention. So I think there was a great fear that Britain was going to be Germanised as well and invaded, and bayoneted babies and people being thrown off church steeples and things.
Mm. And we were talking a moment ago about the sort of processes of governments in responding to crisis, and looking a little bit at the end there, but, you know, the differences between the current US government and the Kennedy administration. What is the British government response to this developing crisis? To what extent is the sort of plan going on? To what extent do they comprehend what they're walking into, or is there kind of a process of accidents?
They start off very much on the back foot, and then they quite quickly get on the front foot. And I guess the biggest change that you see in terms of government and government policy is the decision to introduce conscription. The decision's taken in 1915, conscription starts in 1916, and this is a complete changeover. Britain has never had this sort of militarised society, so there's never been a standing army in the way that there is in every other country. This is a massive compromise for the liberal state, of course, because it cuts right across the main sort of ideologies of liberalism. But there are other things that change as well in government, because this is the first total war. And again, you know, hindsight, we tend to associate the concept of the home front with the Second World War, but the home front as a concept is invented in the First World War. And if you just, we're so familiar with the phrase, but you just break it down and think what that means, what it actually means is this: the front line is not just in the battlefield, the front line is actually in your own home. And we see new departments, like there's a Ministry of War, there's a Ministry of Information. Other countries have propaganda ministries, Britain has a Ministry of Information, and they make, you know, they make promotional films aimed at housewives, telling them how to cook sensibly, how to conserve things. There is actually rationing as well. Again, we think of rationing to be with the Second World War, but there's rationing that goes on. And then one of the huge changes for Britain is that advances in military technology mean that the German army has gunboats and submarines and, of course, zeppelins, and all of these can unleash firepower on Britain, and we see the first air raids. And the effect of this on the national psyche, I think, is massive. You know, people are really terrified by this, because since 1066, Britain's experience of going to war has been a small number of soldiers attached to a professional army going off somewhere else to do it, or sailors going off somewhere else to do it. So it suddenly, you know, enemy action on British soil. It's a big turnaround.
Is there a negative reaction on the part of the general public to this expansion of the state and the fact that you've got rationing, conscription, all these things you've mentioned, or is it something that's accepted, I don't know, in relation to the necessities of war, and then just becomes entrenched in the culture?
It's kind of quite mixed. I mean, in that very chaotic August week before war actually breaks out, you have a huge pro-war demonstration in London, and you have a huge anti-war demonstration a couple of days either side of each other. So there is serious objection to the war, and then there are organisations like the No Conscription Fellowship that oppose conscription. Several people are sent to jail for refusing to go. Some people are court-martialed. They do have a sort of conscientious objection clause, which takes care of some of the objections, but not of all of them. There's less complaints against rationing, I think. There is more of a feeling that that's necessary. But I think by the time rationing is brought in, the death toll is so vast that I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that everybody would have known somebody who died, even if it wasn't a member of their own family. So I think that that makes it more difficult. Some protest against the war is construed as being really anti-patriotic. So, you know, there are sort of incidences of small-scale mutinies and things in the British Army, but nothing like on the scale that there were in the French Army and the German Army.
Is the situation with conscientious objection that you were just mentioning there, the ability to claim that to some degree, is that new? Does the treatment of that change in the context of the First World War, or does it go back further?
Well, if you remember, it's the first time there's been conscription.
Oh, of course, sorry, yes, 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 of course, yes, yes, so you haven't had the problem before, of course, yes, yes. One other thing, we sort of touched a bit on this side of it, but I think it'd be interesting to go a bit further, is can you say a bit more about the experience of women on the home front in all of this? And I mean, are we beginning to see women being drawn into, I don't know, war industries, presumably not service in the armed forces, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, lots of different fields, really, although there are some statistics that suggest that what changes more, particularly in the first year of the war, is not so much the numbers of women who are employed, but the nature of the employment that they do. So they're doing much more visible employment, because, of course, one of the things that collapses on the outbreak of war is domestic service. And another thing that collapses is dressmaking in the textile industry, because that goes over more or less entirely to making khaki and making uniforms. Munitions factories become very big and important female employers, but there are also other, you know, kind of unexpected fields, really, which come in with this whole having to make an effort. So, for example, there's a woman called Dorothy Peel, who before the war has been quietly going along, making a nice little living for herself, writing cookery books and manuals on how to run an efficient household and things. And then suddenly, in the war, she finds herself seconded to the Ministry of War, because government realises that what it actually needs to win the war on the home front is women's knowledge. You know, you can't, there's no point in telling Edwardian, but immediately post-Edwardian men how to cook more efficiently or how to clean more efficiently, because 90% of them are not doing it. So, you know, you need to get this message through to the women, and you need women who can do it. So Dorothy Peel and a couple of other women are roped in, and they sent off on these really large scale tours where they teach people how to cook economically, also how to use new ingredients, because the government's trying to conserve other things, so they're, you know, kind of powdered eggs and things like that start to come in a big way.
And is that empowering women from backgrounds, say, who might previously have, I don't know, lived a much more limited or marginal existence, or is it just meaning that, say, I don't know, women from the upper classes who would have had more opportunities, presumably, to begin with, are branching out?
Well, paradoxically, it is really more the upper class and middle class women who, in a sense, had more limited opportunities before the First World War, because working class women have always worked outside the home. You know, working class women just have what was called the double burden, because they would have to carry on working frequently, particularly if they had men who were in bouts of unemployment. So they would have to carry on working and do the domestic stuff as well, whereas middle-class women were more expected to be in the home and conform to that thing. So I think, in a sense, it's more empowering, really, for middle-class women. It enables them to break out of that role in a very different way.
We'll be right back.
You have to laugh, or else you cry. You have to live, or else you die. You have to laugh, or else you cry.
That was Tom Hark by the Piranhas. And we're staying, broadly speaking, in the period we've just been in, sort of perhaps going back a little bit into the 19th century, and turning to think about a different kind of ending, the movement towards the ending of an empire, in this case the Ottoman Empire. And so I thought I'd start, Alison, by asking you if you could just sort of give us a little bit of context on what the Ottoman Empire was, and yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to emphasise that the Ottoman Empire was very different from the present-day country, Turkey. Most people, even in the 19th century, most European sources referred to it as Turkey, and they tended to impose a kind of national homogeneity over the empire, which simply didn't exist. From the 13th century, it took on a huge number of Balkan territories that were filled with Orthodox Christians, Catholics, and it expanded into North Africa, where it had different sects of Islam. It ruled over many different law schools of Islam as well, which are radically different in their beliefs. So it was a very mixed empire. It had very little to do with the current Turkish Republic. Also, we have to remember that this was an incredibly long-running empire. So it was established in the 13th century, and it continued to exist until 1923. Although in the final years, it was, of course, occupied by Britain and France in rather large chunks. But it struggled along, despite the fact that it was identified by Nicholas I as the sick man of Europe in 1853. It managed to struggle along for another few decades, at least after that. So I think it's also important to emphasise that this wasn't a dying empire. Even at the period of the late 19th century, this still had quite a long way to go.
Could you say a bit about why Nicholas thinks that it is a dying empire, or is this just a sort of insult that's directed at it that actually doesn't have a lot of substance in reality?
I think it's mostly the latter, to be honest, because he reportedly makes this comment when he's having a conversation. It's all kind of apocryphal, but he makes this comment when he's having a conversation with a British official, and they're supposedly deciding on carving up the Ottoman Empire amongst themselves just before the Crimean War. But he did have some evidence. There was already, by that point, the Greek War of Independence. Greece was independent by 1829. There was already a good deal of nationalist thought circulating in the Balkans, in Bulgaria and Serbia, Montenegro. So large territories of the Ottoman Empire, particularly in the breadbasket of the Ottoman Empire, which was perhaps the most important part in terms of the finances, were showing signs that they could imminently break away, particularly if Russia used its influence to stir the non-Muslim populations in a certain direction. So I think certainly the Tsar did think that the Christian populations of the Balkan territories were, to some extent, in his hands, and he could manipulate them in the way that he wanted to. And then the Ottoman Empire could be his empire. He would have an easy way to Constantinople.
And is there a parallel feeling inside the Ottoman Empire that its affairs are entering a period of crisis, that it might, you know, that do they see in any way the possibility of collapse, you know, as you're moving into the later part of the 19th century, or is it still sort of the vision that this very long-standing entity will continue, and these are sort of minor problems in some of the provinces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what is quite extraordinary if you read the Ottoman documents is the self-belief and the confidence of the state, and the fact that most of the things that they were doing in the 19th century were to show to the other powers that they were equal and they could participate in great powers diplomacy. This gets even more, I would say, palpable under the period of Abdulhamid II, who is in Europe known as the Red Sultan. So this is known as the most despotic period of the Ottoman Empire. But a lot of recent works that have worked on the Ottoman archival sources have shown how sophisticated his rule was and how everything was being engineered to show that he was worthy of being taken at the table of the great powers. So it's interesting how the former historiography of decline that was depicted mostly through the use of European sources has been turned around recently by Ottomanists who are working from the Ottoman archives. But of course that's giving an opposite view, so you have to sort of bring together some other sources as well. And to add to that, lots of people have been starting to use minority language sources, Armenian sources, Greek sources, and sources in Balkan languages to give more local perspectives on the transformation of the 19th century. So I think it's about balancing the perspective on decline, because you can't deny that the Ottoman Empire had lost territory. By the 1860s and 70s, many of the Balkan states had won independence and autonomy. So that is undeniable. The empire wasn't expanding after that point as it was in the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent. But at the same time, the internal perspective was still strong, and the empire was regenerating until the very end.
So would I be right in saying that you've got a sort of situation where it also the perspectives are very different whether you're in the Ottoman Empire or outside, but also very different depending on which part of the Ottoman Empire you're in, how strong it feels, whether you want to get rid of it, all these kinds of questions.
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on what community you are. So remember that the Ottoman Empire was made up of various religions. So even within the Armenian community, the Armenians were Christian Orthodox community, but they were also Protestants, large numbers converted in the 19th century, and also there was a Catholic community too. But just within the Armenian Orthodox community, there was a huge gulf between the peasants in eastern Anatolia, who were having to fight with the Kurds who were being settled on the same land in the late 19th century, and the elites of Constantinople who were supporting the Sultan and didn't want any change to the status quo. So there's a huge sort of, it's a bit anachronistic to say it's a class conflict, but at the same time there was a huge amount of tension between the lower class Armenians, the provincial Armenians, and the elites of the capital.
So when it does finally fall end in I think 1923, if I remember that rightly, do you have a situation where there's a really big transformative moment and kind of I suppose the world changes for people within those territories, or is there in fact quite a bit of continuity between the two, between the before and after, I suppose?
I mean, that was the difficulty in trying to come up with a subject for this programme, actually, because I'm all for putting the Ottoman Empire in the same, bracket as the Western states. But at the same time, I couldn't think of a particular transitional moment. But at the same time, the Kurdish referendum over the past few days was getting me thinking about the sort of the Ottoman Empire state reflex against minorities, which continues today to some extent under Erdogan. And the way that Erdogan was describing the Kurdish referendum as treachery, that really reminded me of the kind of things that Abdulhamid II and then later under the Young Turk government would say about the Armenian revolutionaries. And a lot of the same phrases are used today, actually, to describe the Kurdish problem as the Armenian problem. So that got me thinking about the Congress of Berlin, because that is actually a huge moment of transition for the Armenian political approach. And that marks, I think, that turning point for Abdulhamid II to start viewing the Armenians as treacherous and as going to the European powers to secure concessions and to secure them to supervise the eastern provinces of the empire. And Abdulhamid II had a very paternal approach to the non-Muslim populations, which continues under Erdogan, I think. And he that was something he reacted very negatively to. And after that moment, he started to clamp down much more on Armenian activities. And you have the converse side, that the Armenians saw the Congress of Berlin actually as a failure, because they hoped to secure greater rights in the eastern provinces, and they hoped to secure Russian supervision of these improved conditions. And they failed to achieve that. So they were hugely disappointed by Congress of Berlin, even though Abdulhamid II saw it as them actually winning some concessions. So what happened with the Armenian community was they started to develop revolutionary methods instead of going through the liberal means that they were trying before. So I think the Congress of Berlin marks this clash between the two approaches and the realization maybe that the paternal approach to the non-Muslim subjects couldn't continue.
That's in 1878.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. The other thing I just was thinking about in the course of what you were saying is there seems to be a sort of nostalgia for the empire at the moment. I've read a few articles about television series sort of going back to Ottoman times and suggestions that Erdogan is trying to sort of draw on the mantle of that to legitimise the current government. Was there nostalgia in the late 20s for this entity that disappeared, or did it pass away and sort of people didn't think much of it at that time?
I think that the Young Turks were trying to make a break away from the corruption of the Sultan. That was their big selling point, really. So the generation of the Young Turks, which is basically the same generation as the Republican leaders and Mustafa Kemal, they all represent a sort of opposition to the Sultan, although they accepted to have him in the background as a sort of figurehead for a while. They define themselves as moving against the Ottoman Empire. And even today, actually, you have quite a strong split in Turkish society between the Kemalists, who see themselves as successors of Mustafa Kemal, and the secular approach of the Young Turks that he inherited, versus Erdogan's people, who see themselves as the inheritors of the Ottoman legacy. Which was the Islamic, the great caliphate, the last caliphate before ISIS, of course. So there is very much this sort of tranche in society that continues to manifest itself today.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart I have but one desire, and that one is you. No other will do. I've lost all ambition for worldly acclaim. I just want to be the one you love. And with your admission that you feel the same, I'll have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. Thank you. lost all ambition for worldly acclaim. I just want to be the one you love. And with your admission that you feel the same, I'll have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
That was I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire by Patti Page. I sort of feel we should send that as a request to certain of the leaders out there in some of these situations. I wonder whether we think that these moments of crisis are always going to be with us. Is this sort of moments of cathartic change or crisis a regular occurrence, something that will keep coming back? Do we make any progress looking at the historical record in terms of how we address them, or do different governments and so on tend to come at them without learning any of the lessons from the past? Or is that too vast a question for anyone to I'm probably rambling a bit.
I think you need to narrow us down a bit.
I could talk about the Turkish example. There is quite a strong strain amongst Ottomanist historians that argue that if the mistakes of the past had been acknowledged and had been perhaps given some kind of reparation, then these mistakes wouldn't be being repeated by the Turkish government at the moment. And I'm not sure I agree. I mean, I think it would be fantastic to have acknowledgement for groups of the population who are now in diaspora, but I'm not sure that this actually would have the effect of changing approaches to government. It seems to be very optimistic to me.
Does the experience of that moment of ending up in the war and then the changes in government, how far does that impact considerably on, say, for example, government and people as they're approaching the crisis in the 30s, or not so much?
I think it really has a big impact on people like Chamberlain and actually on the policy of appeasement, which, you know, again, hindsight, people have really condemned him for that. But I think if you look at it from Chamberlain's position, having seen what war did the previous time, that and the proximity, you know, 1918 demobilisation really not completed till 1919, 1920, and then, you know, 1937, 1938, 1939. So it's very, very, very close, and I think that really does have an impact in terms of making the government a lot more cautious.
Do you think there's a reason why it impacts some more than others? That obviously Chamberlain feels, you know, is very conscious of that legacy. But on the other hand, you have got the opponents of appeasement who seem to be more prepared to launch into another war. Is that just sort of temperamental differences of particular leaders, or is there something more at work?
I think there's more of a thing about who really grasps what's going on. I mean, you can see this in cultural phenomenon. I don't know if you know the wonderful British Second World War film about the life and death of Colonel Blimp, where you have exactly this character who's fought one war and then thinks, so it's all happening again, you know, and it's actually takes a German friend of his to say, this is very different, this is something very different. You also see it in that Irene Nemirovsky's novel Suite Française, which she conceptualizes as a five-volume series of novels. She actually only writes three of them before she is exterminated in a Nazi camp, because despite the fact that she converted to Christianity 20 years before the outbreak of the war, they kind of don't count that and decide that she's still too Jewish and French to boot. But in Suite Française, you see exactly the same thing, and she's actually planned it out. The final novel from memory is called something like Regeneration or Reconciliation or something, and it's exactly that she's seeing, you know, there's been one invasion of France and actually this is another invasion of France, and we have to learn to get along with the enemy and then the enemy will go, which is why controversially she has that very controversial middle section where a French woman falls in love with the German officer who's billeted with her, and that's all to do with that, you know, that experience the first time round, that they will come, they will stay for a bit, and then they will go, and then we'll get round to living together again.
Mm. Tom, I was thinking in the sort of Cuba and Trump context, there's a lot of analysis that seems to be suggesting he's not paying any attention to the lessons of the past, and I've been particularly seeing these lines of argument that we've never had a attempt to deal with a sort of nuclear standoff in the way that currently he's dealing with it. Do you think that's true? And if so, why?
I find it incredibly difficult to make any predictions about Trump at the moment, because everything I say, seemingly the next day, a new article comes out that will kind of label Trump in a different light. I think at the moment what we're seeing between North Korea and the United States is a very long hangover from the Korean War. And this has been something that has been going on for nearly 50 years now. South Korea has a huge US Army presence, and this was always something that was going to tip off at some point. I do think that the election of Trump has allowed Kim Jong-il to push some of the diplomatic kind of tools that he's wanted to for a while. The reason why North Korea is has been developing nuclear weapons has been to get a seat on the table, to be able to kind of remove some of the sanctions the United Nations have been placing on it time and time again. Trump as a president is really difficult to comment on, and I do find that at the moment, even making comparisons between him and Reagan, which is a kind of quite useful comparison to think about, mainly because of the use of their language. It's difficult. They're different sort of communicators. And I think this is the thing we need to think about when analysing what we can tell about Trump's presidency. It's this idea of communication, the way he uses language, which is incredibly clumsy and crude to an extent. And because of that, with international relations so delicate a lot of the time, it's difficult to kind of separate what's going on from Trump tweeting to what's actually being discussed in the Pentagon at the moment. And North Korea remains the biggest foreign policy problem for most of the Western world at the moment. And how it develops, I'm not 100% sure at the moment, to be honest. But it's something that I think is going to continue and hopefully won't reach an escalation point like we got to with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm terrified about it. I'm buying canned goods all the time, just in case at the moment.
I was going to say, we're almost seeing something new under the sun. Have I got time for one more? I wanted to just pick up on something with the Ottoman story, which is I'm sure I've seen sort of arguments about the way that the Ottoman Empire created a culture in which the different religions could coexist more easily than is perhaps the case in parts of that world now. And yet that's one of the legacies that hasn't apparently sort of endured. And I just wonder whether you have any comment on why that particular one has not done so. Or if I'm wrong about the...
No, you're absolutely right. I think it's a bit like the sick man story, that in the post-Ottoman nation states, it's remembered as the Ottoman yoke. And this has been what has gone down in history, in popular history anyway. People tend to forget that. Non-Muslims, Christians of various denominations had a legal status. They weren't equal to Muslims if they were in a court of law, but there's plenty of evidence now that they chose to use the Muslim courts over the Christian courts, which were also available for them. So things like this indicate that they were relatively happy with the status quo. Also, as I mentioned before, you had merchants who were at the Sultan's court. The architects that I study were at the right hand of the Sultan's, so they had a very privileged existence, and they didn't want that state of affairs to change at all. And yes, you have the division into religious communities, so that each religious community has, in theory, its own representation. So you have a patriarch or a grand rabbi. You have the separate religious courts, but also the access to the Muslim courts. And so you do have this sort of some degree of autonomy, well, not exactly autonomy, but representation anyway, within the Ottoman state. You have a sort of state within...
Am I right? So I would like to... I think we're probably out of time for any more discussion. I'd like to thank my colleagues there for helping to focus my rather waffly question in the manner of the best kind of seminar. So I'd like to thank Professor Christa Carman, Dr. Alison Wharton, and Dr. Tom Bishop for coming along to talk about this idea of ends of worlds. And hopefully the world will not end in the next month. So they will restrain Trump from pressing the button. And we shall be back in about a month's time.
Quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.